when we were really brave, we would go to our rooftop and watch the anti-aircraft missiles shoot up in the air. And I just remember to my seven-year-old eyes, these beautiful patterns, red patterns all over the sky looked as good as any 4th of July fireworks. But underneath that awe of seeing all this beauty, there was terror. I was like, who is the lottery of death going to get next?
As a CIA officer in Iraq during the war, I lived in a world where power meant weapons, money, and force. And yet, I kept encountering a deeper power. Policies changed, governments shifted, military plans often failed, but connection to each other, to the earth, and to something larger than ourselves kept proving more powerful than violence and destruction. I'm Janessa Gans Wilder, and this is Peace is Power, a podcast exploring how peace will change your life and our world. Each week, I speak with leaders, artists, activists, and spiritual thinkers around one core question. What if true power is not domination, but connection? Welcome to Peace is Power. My guest today is Ari Hornavar, an Iranian-American writer, artist, and founder of Rumi with a View. Ari was born in Shiraz, Iran, and she came of age through revolution, war, repression, and exile. At 14, her parents sent her to the U.S. for her safety, and she wasn't fully reunited with her family for more than 20 years. But what moves me so much about Ari is that she has not let that pain shut her down, but instead has used it as fuel to open herself up. Her work is about rehumanization through art, poetry, joy, dance, and embodiment. In this conversation, we talk about Iran, war, women, exile, dehumanization, nonviolence, and the courage it requires to keep our hearts open in this world. Ari shares a childhood memory I will never forget, standing on rooftops while missiles lit up the sky, as people called out verses of Rumi into the night. Even in terror, there was beauty. Even under bombs, there was a sanctuary no weapon could touch. And that, to me, is peace is power. Not peace as passivity, but peace as the power to stay human. Here is my conversation with Ari Hornavar. So Ari, it is such an honor to be here with you today. And I want to just start by reading aspects of your bio, because it does demonstrate that richness and depth of your journey. So you are an award-winning Iranian-American writer, artist, and speaker, and the founder of Rumi with a View, an initiative that builds bridges between the arts, social justice, and well-being. You were born in Shiraz, Iran, and at age 7, I believe is when the Iranian regime took over, followed by the 8-year-long Iran-Iraq War. You've described this as a war from outside and also within, especially on women. And all this precipitated your parents sending you over to the U.S. when you were 14 years old, alone, and you were not reunited as a family for over 20 years. And you've written about this in an allegorical way in the award-winning novel, A Girl Called Rumi. So did I get all that right? Hearing parts of your bio back to you, is there a part of your background that on hearing it today strikes you most?
Well, I'm part of the older generation of Iranians who actually do remember, they can recall what it was like to just be able to, as a kid, run around. I think things are changing, but for many, many years, women weren't allowed to ride a bicycle or sing in public. You know, our rights were cut in half. So I saw the contrast. It was a literal thing, too, because a woman's testimony, according to the strict version of the Sharia law, was half as good as a man's testimony. So you needed two women to equal one man, or inheritance laws and divorce laws and things that were just not present before the revolution, and before the Islamists took over and women lost their rights. So I'm at the unique perspective of having experienced that and also have lived most of my childhood through the war.
8 years.
7 years, really, because I left right at the tail end. So when the Islamic Republic took over, I was six, and then I left at the age of 14, and it took a year before the war began with Iraq. Really, Saddam Hussein attacked Iran. It was a war of aggression on his part.
So, what was it like for you at age 14? I couldn't get over hearing that you were alone. And I'm sure it was because of safety issues and all that was happening in Iran at the time. And then I think you mentioned that something had happened to a friend of your sister, which is why, your parents decided you would be better off outside Iran and in the US. But to go and face that as a young girl, what was that like?
Yeah, I think there is this narrative in the West right now that the whole thing is kind of blown out of proportion. Like women in Iran are just really upset because they can't wear bikinis in public. You know, like making it so such a superficial narrative about an absolute assault on human rights. So just to paint you a picture, when I was seven, you know, if I got into a bus, women had to sit in the back of the bus, like a reminiscent of apartheid. You know, there was a gender apartheid. So again, strides have been made. The Woman Life Freedom Revolution in 2022 really did change things to some way. But the crackdown on dissidents is a real human rights issue. The Iran officially executes more children than any other place in the world. And again, you know, a lot of people bring in Israel. Yes, Israel has killed and continues to kill kids, but with official trials, Iran is on record as executing the most number of what they call minor offenders, which is basically children. So this is the climate in which I was living. And my sister's classmate, she was a senior in high school. Now, half of my sister's classmates were in prison for who knows what, because none of the, you know, crimes were made public. They would just nab you. You know, if someone said something to you, they would nab you. If they saw like a little bit of hair showing, they would take you to prison. So that's half of her class was gone. And then one of them was executed. And when my dad talked to this young woman, that young girl, really a child, her name was Roya. My dad was like, "Well, what happened?" You know, asked her dad. And what he said was that they never told us. They just said, "Come get her body." So this is the level of due process that we're dealing with in a place where it does not value human rights or human lives, including children's. And they also make the parents pay for the bullets that they use to execute your kids.
To add insult to injury.
That was also part of it, yeah. Or right now, they're not giving back the bodies of people who they have killed in the protests, or have been killed in the protests too. So there's definitely not just about wearing bikinis.
Hey, listeners, if you're wanting to go deeper in your peacebuilding journey, come visit us at Euphrates.org. Euphrates Institute is the organization I founded after my time serving in Iraq during the war. We offer courses, resources, and a global community of peacebuilders from more than 60 countries who are learning how to practice peace within and without. You can learn more at Euphrates.org. And yet, Ari, in that environment, you were such a rebel. You were dressing up as a boy, putting graffiti on walls. Like, what was it in you that wanted to rebel and risk so much in that environment?
I think immediately, like, this is one of those things what radicalized you. It was when I saw, like, my best friend was a boy, and we used to just be wild together, go on our adventures, which was lovely because it was safe enough that kids could do stuff like that. And it's unthinkable now, right? For like 7-year-old to do stuff.
Yeah. Leave for hours and they never come back till late.
And all of a sudden, he had all of the freedom to do whatever he wanted to, dress how he did before, and appear in public the way that he chose. And all my rights were taken away, or all the ways that made me a really happy child was taken away from me. And, you know, like, I had to sit on the back of the bus. How humiliating is it to have all these rights and then be like, oh, my God, now I can't even ride the bus without, even though there's lots of seats open in the front, I can't use that. So just seeing how women were treated over and over again, how men who stood up for women or for civil liberties or for freedom, how they were treated, all of that made me so enraged. So yes, at first I was like, how can I get around this? So I cut my hair and just pretended to be a boy. And that lasted for a good chunk of time before well-meaning neighbors told my parents, this is not okay. She could get into trouble. You could get into trouble. And so that was the end of that. But I would sneak out at night and I would write anti-regime graffiti on the walls. And that's the stuff that is, you know, again, theocracies have an inherent problem that anytime you do anything against the government, it's an act against God, which is the most supreme horrible thing that you could do. So if I'm writing anti-Khomeini or anti-regime graffiti on the wall, that means that I am committing a crime against God in their eyes. And that would be proper enough evidence to haul me away, put me in prison, or even maybe execution, depending on what kind of judge you would get. So that's why my parents made the very difficult decision to bring me to the U.S. and leave me there because they didn't get a visa. My sister was still in Iran finishing her studies. So it was this very heartbreaking decision.
I see. So that's why they had to go back. They hadn't gotten the visa and that left you there with this wonderful opportunity. But I'm sure at the time, Ari, it was so dislocating, disconnecting to be in a completely different culture, different language. And at an age when you're trying to find yourself anyway, and then to be thrust into this completely foreign environment as a refugee, in a sense, what was that like for you?
It was like the ultimate sink or swim situation for me, because I understood that I couldn't go back. I understood that this was my life now. And yes, again, I could wear a bikini to a grocery store and no one would bat an eye, but I didn't have my parents. I didn't have my best friend, all the food that I was used to. Rumi has a really beautiful verse about how one feels like they're cut from the reed. Vishna is ne chun hekayat mikonad, as jada'i ha shekayat mikonad. Listen to the voice of the name or the flute, which is telling you is like complaining. It's like the lamenting all the pain of separation. So I felt like that cut reed. I was cut from my my motherland, my actual mother, the source of all comfort.
Your mother tongue.
My mother tongue, yeah.
I only have experienced a taste of that, Ari, and it is still the most traumatizing experience of my life when my parents shipped me off at 12 to live with a family that we had never met. I didn't speak a word of the language. All of a sudden, I had to go to school in this foreign environment. And I remember the first few weeks or so feeling like I was in outer space. I was so alone. It wasn't even that I just couldn't connect or communicate with another human being. It's almost as if I didn't know myself. Because who was I if I didn't have my normal personality? I didn't have my family as a bearing. I just had felt so cut off. So I love that verse from Rumi that speaks to that complete dislocation, that disconnection from one another, from, you know, my heart goes out to so many people who are experiencing that very tangibly as refugees, as victims. But there's also, and I know you've spoken to this in other things that you've written, even at a deeper level in terms of the epidemic of loneliness that we're experiencing, or even this disconnection and this dislocation from each other in our society and our community. I love that poetry can get at that longing and that sense of, but those of us who have experienced that, it is a trauma in a way, a pain, whether it's recognized or not.
Absolutely. And I love that you use the word dislocation, because dislocation in a physical sense, anytime you have a dislocation happening in your body, that is a painful process. And when you look at it from the nervous system perspective, that dislocation of your whole being to another place that is completely strange is also very disorienting. That disorientation is very expensive and costly for the nervous system. So it just has to keep working so hard. It's so taxing to just stay alive, stay afloat. So many refugees that I work with are exhausted. They're just absolutely exhausted. They're so tapped out because of that.
I guess that brings me into whether you are still, I mean, it's not like your journey, Ari, has ever gotten easier. You went from, you know, this tumultuous upbringing and then being thrust into a new environment and then having, talk about dislocation, having to, from here, watch what's going on in your homeland. And I guess I would just ask, how are you doing right now? How are you coping with all that's going on?
Thank you so much for that question. It's been such a lovely silver lining to hear people ask that question. So many friends who know me well have asked, how is your heart? And it really brings me back to, how is my heart right now? It's a moment of reflection and seeing. It allows me to look inward and take stock, take inventory of how am I feeling in this very moment? So just that moment of slowing down, which I invite all of our viewers to just slow down for one moment and just tune in and see, like, really what condition your condition is in right now. And just let your breath flow in and out. And just by doing that, I'm putting my hand on my heart and I'm feeling that my heart is so appreciative of being asked, how are you? And giving it the gift of space, the gift of breath. And when I do that, when I give myself that gift of space, then I can really feel more capacious, have more capacity to really see where the hurt is. So tapping into savoring the present moment and what is pleasant in the moment, which is a really nice nourishing breath, allowed me to just be more present with the suffering. I mean, again, that there is that vicarious trauma, right? Watching your family in distress, or watching your loved ones or people of your homeland crying over their children who have been murdered by American bombs, or these beautiful heritage sites destroyed, you know, the ones that have lasted thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And yes, you know, you can say, you know, whatever, this is, you can rebuild, or, but you know that all of these beautiful heritage sites have been through sanctions, have been through wars, have been through invasions, and they have stood. And to see them, you know, crumble is really heartbreaking. Or food sources or water sources being poisoned, or the environment taking a beating, the earth, our mother earth, just the all the animals, all the plants. And and all the refugees, like more than 3 million people are internally displaced right now, almost 3.5 million people. So yeah, it is really difficult to witness. And at the same time, it really compels me to keep increasing my capacity, keep doing the capacity building, keep tuning into what's right in my world, because I'm so fortunate, and tuning into gratitude as a source of nourishment and resilience, so I can bear witness and do whatever advocacy that I can in my own tiny person capacity to be able to help what's happening.
I really appreciate, Ari, what you, basically the process that you just walked through. It is not in numbing or denying or pretending everything is great, grand, wonderful. You know, it's actually opening our heart to acknowledge the pain, the suffering, and the reality of what's going on. It's not denying any of that, but then it's also not wallowing in that either, wallowing in despair. You know, I think so many of us feel anger, despair, and powerlessness. But then you also described letting the despair and anger as fuel to your increase your capacity. And in that, I hear a sense of agency that, oh, I'm not powerless. I can do something. I have agency. I have power within me. And I would love to know, how does that show up for you right now, that sense of power and agency?
Again, we just feel so helpless because we feel like this war was without the American people's consent. It was unpopular from the start and is really hurting regular Americans. But it's also revealing so much about ourselves, our world, our leaders, how the resistance movements work. What are we doing to be part of the solution? And just because the system really thrives on our apathy or exhaustion or overwhelm to just do what it does. And what I see is that, well, what kind of actions can I take that could reduce this real harm? Again, I'm just one person, but if thousands and millions of people were doing something, you know, you and I have talked about that 3.5% number of people, that's when the real change happens, 3.5% of people changing, doing something that is helpful. So one of the things that we have been talking about is partnering with the armed forces, people who are in the military, and supporting them. Like, let's not put them in harm's way. Let's not send them to a war to die for this senseless greed that is not helping any of us on the ground. And also, you know, at the same time, you're inflicting harm on my family, my friends, my motherland. So there, I'm just so encouraged that there are so many veterans who are speaking out. And I've partnered with some of them to speak out about becoming a conscientious objector in the military. And there's a process, and it's not easy. But right now we have more conscientious objectors than ever.
That's right. And also another project I've loved of yours, Ari, is the humanization. So often, I feel like what we're seeing playing out, well, on both sides, there's the brilliant Lego videos from Iran, which are actually very truth-telling in a lot of ways. But then there's also the propaganda that the U.S. is putting out. You know, I can't remember the video game, but they're showing targets as if it's in the video game. And what you're doing is rehumanizing the places that we're bombing. And you've had this series going of like, get to know the people and places that you're bombing. And that's in a way to close that distance. This is not some abstract video game. This is real life. You know, this is not a game. It's real life. And I don't know what inspired you to do that, but I love that project.
Yeah, thank you. So my work is centered around reparative rehumanization. And a lot of times building joy, spaces of joyfulness, celebration, ways to rehumanize ourselves and everyone around us, and as a way of healing, as a way of repairing, and as a way of course, rehumanizing. And I think it was when the Iran Air Flight 655 was shut down by Americans in the 80s, like late 80s, and 290 people on board, including 65 children, were killed. George Bush Sr. was campaigning to become a president. At the time, he was a VP. And what he said, and I quote, is like, "I'll never apologize for the United States of America. I don't care what the facts are."
Wow.
So again, coming from a world where I was dehumanized as a woman, now I was seeing a different type of dehumanization, like the bully energy that I don't care what the facts are. I don't care what the facts are. We did what we did. 65 children, 290 lives, you know, I'll be damned. I don't care. So like not even an apology. So how dehumanizing is that? So that's kind of what radicalized me to the American empire, and how dehumanizing it is to its own people and to the rest of the world. And so the project of rehumanization is to just go in, zoom in and see what are we doing? How are we causing harm as an American taxpayer, as someone who benefits from living in the imperial core? And what the project was like when people kept talking about when Mina school, girls' school, and 165 plus people, mostly little girls, were murdered by a Tomahawk missile.
And also without an apology.
Also without an apology. Ooh, that's right. People talk about that, but they don't know what is MENOP. What kind of a demographic does it have? Did you know that there are Afro-Iranians who are thriving, and there's just like all these different ethnicities with Persians and Kurds and Baluch and Arab Iranians, and they're all like having this thriving agricultural hub where little girls went to school and didn't come home. So that's how I started. I said, I'm going to begin a series called Get to Know People and Places That You Bomb. And I'm going to start with MENOP. And that's kind of the description that I added, that little girls that used to go to school. And it got quite a bit of a reception from the American and the world audience. And so I just started taking different places, people, like I did an episode on schools and universities that have been destroyed or partially bombed, which is more than 700 in Iran, you know, like more than 20,000 bombs were dropped on Iran by Israel and by the U.S. And that's just staggering. It's staggering the level of damage, the level of dehumanization that can occur to allow for that kind of a atrocity, war crime to take place. Bridges, you know, again, heritage sites, and of course, people's lives are so precious. So yeah, that's how it began.
There's just such a depth radiating from you, and I don't know if it's a sensitivity or your sense of compassion it's funny that so often, you know, the world would discount that as weakness or as soft or, you know, overly sensitive. And yet it's such a capacity to hold so much without breaking, like to hold so much. I want to say pain, but I know it's not just pain. It's all of it. It's the love. It's the humanity. It's the depth. And I'm so in awe that you are continuing to be that way, even in the midst of all that. It would be so much easier to shut down or to cut off that part of yourself that is opening your heart in the midst of all this. It's such a strength. It's like the opposite of weakness. You know, it's like this, I wanted to say, like, often it's seen as feminine and discounted or dismissed in a way. And yet it is so, there's so much power in that. There's so much strength in that. And yeah, I don't have even a question in it. I guess I just gratitude for you continuing to open when everything is closing, would want to close off our hearts to what is happening in the world. And what does it take to open? Like, do you have, I guess here's a question. Do you have a spiritual practice or a personal peace practice that helps you keep opening and putting your heart forward with all this craziness?
Thank you for that. And I want to say that I see the same in you. Absolutely, that keep opening yourself when everything, your instincts are like, close, close, protect yourself to all this.
Protect yourself, yes.
And you're absolutely right. It is very feminine. And I don't know why it has become a reason to apologize for this beautiful capacity. And imagine, and it is, again, it is so easy to close yourself up. And so much of our problems right now in the world is because people are closing themselves up. Like, you could not imagine these, our leaders, ever committing the atrocities and the cruelties that they are committing if they had that capacity, if they were a little bit more open to hold the suffering. It is easy to be like a toddler and lash out and have no capacity to hold your anger in and just scream at the world and break things and shoot your gun if you have it, or tell people to shoot their guns. But to hold suffering without causing harm is an art, a gift, a skill that we all could, including myself, develop more fully.
In a way, it's a more developed and more mature, and that's what you're pointing to, because you know, it's easier to be like a toddler, but it actually to hold both, and it is a more mature way of being, to be able to hold that nuance and to hold the tension.
It is. And again, like, so much of our problems is because the feminine and the women have been cut out. We've been cut off to those parts of ourselves, that development that is so necessary for a human to be a fully integrated human being. And even in our constitution, when the founding fathers, you know, they got the idea of the U.S. Constitution from the Haudenosaunee, which is the Iroquois
Confederacy.
Exactly. So they appropriated that, or they got inspired by it, but they did not take the most important bit, which is the clan mothers, which is the group of elder mothers who saw seven generations, who thought about seven generations before and seven generations after for every decision. They could remove the chief of the tribe. They oversaw the economy, the agriculture, the food resources, and so many other beautiful traditions that and practices that they implemented to allow their world to run in a sane, functional manner. Imagine if we had that in our world, the clan mothers who, you know, like, we refer to them, and they were not driven by greed or by personal gain, but really honoring all of our relations and seven generations back and seven generations forward.
Well, on the topic of women, I've been so inspired by the courage that the Iranian women have shown again and again, and not just this past year in January, but for years now. Do you think that there is a message that they are trying to articulate that the world has not heard or maybe has not understood?
Yeah, that women are in so many ways more capable than men. And to cut them out of the conversation, to deny them that seat at the table is again like cutting a part of yourself off or making the society worse off than it is. So that's basically it, you know, like when we say matriarchy or feminism or any of that, it doesn't mean that women are better than men necessarily at all. But it's like we are looking out for all of us. So all of us can, all of our relations, including the earth, the animals, other humans, to thrive and be able to have everything that they need. And that such a world is absolutely possible. So that's what they have been at the core of what they've been fighting, the Iranian women.
So it's not just about their own freedoms. It's about the well-being of the society. Is that what you're saying? The well-functioning of the whole?
What's good if I'm having all my needs met, but my children are suffering, or my brother is suffering, or my husband, or my water is being poisoned? It's not at all about that idea of being individual salvation. It's about a collective resistance and a collective liberation.
I have to hear the story again of you as, I think you were a seven-year-old, on the rooftop. One, it goes to so much of what we already been talking about, the both the pain and the joy and what we have capacity for, even in the most challenging of circumstances. But I hope you can share the story of you as a little girl on the rooftop, because I just feel like it speaks to this moment in time that we are all in. Like it's your past, but it's our collective present. So if you don't mind.
Absolutely. I was seven when the war with Iraq began. Saddam Hussein attacked Iran and started an actual war that took 8 years and destroyed countless lives. At least a million people were killed. So this is when we would go on our rooftops. And this is like 1900 weapons. So nothing like what's happening now. You know, it was still really scary and traumatizing to be a child during the war. So I really feel for the people who are in the midst of it in any part of the world that is experiencing war and violence. But we would go to our rooftops when there would be like a siren. The sirens were color coded, and red siren, it's like, this is code red. You gotta get to a safe place. But when we were really brave, we would go to our rooftop and watch the anti-aircraft missiles shoot up in the air. And I just remember to my seven-year-old eyes, these beautiful patterns, red patterns all over the sky, looked as good as any 4th of July fireworks. But underneath that awe of seeing all this beauty, there was terror. Like, I was like, who is the lottery of death going to get next? Is it going to be me, my best friend, my teacher, my sister in Tehran? And then from another rooftop, someone would shout Rumi in the clear night air. And in Farsi, he would say, Bar hamegan gar ze falak zahr bebarad hame shab, man shekarandar, 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 shekaran. Even if from the sky poison befalls all, I am still sweetness wrapped in sweetness, wrapped in sweetness, wrapped in sweetness. And then a passerby below would respond with another verse. Digaronat ishq mikhonand o man sultan ishq ای تو بالاتر ز وهم این و آن بی من مرو.
While others are singing about love, I am the Sultan of love.
And verses like that would go right into my 7-year-old heart and radiate to every cell of my being until I was everything and nothing at the same time. My world was as glorious as the 13th century mystics. And what balm could ever touch that?
I think from that place is the rebellion. Like, instead of fighting back, you all were fighting back with the most intense beauty and art and love and freedom and inviolability. Like, you were demonstrating that that part of you could never be touched, that that which is most holy, that the love could never be touched. You as creators, you as beauty lovers, as artists, as like, it's just, it was such an act, not only of, you know, protection, and but it was such an act of power, just such an act of defiance.
Such an act of defiance. And there is a term, scientific term, called savoring intervention. So amid all the horror, we were able to find a sanctuary within. So there's, it's an actual intervention when something horrible is happening, and you go within and you find that sanctuary and that beautiful inner world where nothing can touch you. And it is a source of power. It is a source of resilience. And so many people during the, you know, like the, I don't know if you heard, but people were on the bridges holding hands, protecting the bridges in Iran, or there was a...
Human chains, I think they were calling it.
Human chains, and or Ali Ghamsari, he's a prominent musician in Iran, and he took vigil and started playing and had a concert at a nuclear power plant, the Damavand, the biggest one in the country. It's like, not a nuclear, but energy, just an electricity power plant. And it was kind of like, all right, if you want to shoot, you know, this. So it was just like they saw music, or they saw their own way of their community holding hands as that source of power. And I saw that some people in the US, I saw some posts that were misunderstood that, and they were like, oh my God, it's so sad that they think that just because they're holding hands on bridges or they're playing music, that the U.S. won't bomb them. Isn't that sad? You know, like they think because they're human, they won't get bombed. And I was like, no, you completely misunderstand. They know full well what the U.S. is capable of, because we've been at the receiving end of this for years and years and years, for decades. So it's not about being too naive that, oh, they're not going to shoot us if we do this. But they choose to die with honor and dignity. And just, it's a nonviolent statement to, while the world is watching in 4K, that this is what we choose to do, and that's what the U.S. chooses to do. And who really holds the real power here?
And in a way, each of them is saying, what bomb can touch that? They are already proving to themselves, no bomb, even if it takes my life, can touch my sense of independence, my sense of identity, my art, my love. You know, they're all in defiance of that oppression.
And my sense of agency, which is so vital to that rehumanization, to feeling the dignity of being human.
So you mentioned nonviolence, and there is a burning question that I'm sitting with, and I would love to ask you. And it's basically, you know, where you come down on violence in general, even in the name of defense, because so many, I saw a post yesterday. Oh my gosh, I have to read part of it. I won't say who it is, but a woman with 500,000 followers. And she said, violence, fighting back is the only way. And the resistance is only trying to defend ourselves. If you're not going to fight, then just shut up. And so many people right now are throwing on, no, you know, we're defending ourselves. They're the aggressors. No, we're defending ourselves. And so I'm wrestling with, you know, is defense. And then Byron Katie on a spiritual level says defense is the first act of war. And so yeah, just for you, like, where are you sitting with this right now in terms of when is violence okay, even as a defense mechanism or not?
I find that I am not a pacifist, although maybe I am personally a pacifist, but I see the necessity of also, you know, resisting occupation or resisting being bombed or fighting back in a situation like that. And when the bombs are falling, should you just like be like, ah, you know? So yes, you do a human chain, but also, yeah, shoot those bombs down, you know, like do some damage to the other side too. That seems like a perfectly reasonable response if there's a war of choice being...
To defend yourself, yeah, against the aggressor. You
know, against the aggressor. So I don't know where I would fall, like when I was in a situation as such, would I take up arms? I am not this completely... I would not say no to that necessarily. Maybe I would, maybe I wouldn't. I don't know. But I think it's very situational and it's not a blanket situation, blanket answer to when is violence okay and when it's not. And again, you know, so many women personally, we're dealing with a terrible sexual assault culture. Like to not defend yourself against that, that's ridiculous. It's very situational for me.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly know philosophically and even, you know, following teachings of Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. And it was definitely defense, but in a nonviolent way. And yet how in a realistic situation when there is violence actively, you know, being put against you, how to defend yourself nonviolently. I mean, I guess that is. And then if it just seems like appeasement and, you know, all these terms are thrown around, I think, right now in the activist movement, that what does that look like, whether it's to stand up to an administration perceived as, you know, destructive and aggressive or in war context. And yeah, it's just an interesting, and not that I want to make it abstract, you know, then it's just becomes theorizing. But it's just something, and that's why I'm even trying to live, like, what does it mean to live nonviolence with my family or even in my thought or against myself? You know, how many times am I aggressive towards myself or defensive? And so it is helpful to reduce it down to, no, not abstractions, but where does the rubber meet the road, even in my daily walk and talk?
Absolutely. Yeah, sometimes not responding to violence can be a violent act itself. So yeah, like if you see a man hitting a child, you know, there's so many different situations that we can draw upon where for violence or trying to prevent violence and is a very legitimate response. And I also can think of, I think it was Kwame Ture who said, in order for nonviolence to work, your opponent must have a conscience. The oppressor must have a conscience.
Oh, interesting.
So there is that part of it too, where if they don't see the message that you're trying to send with your nonviolence, it's not going to work.
Although I guess spiritually everyone does, but maybe it's just veiled or hidden and it's, you know, in a way seeing that every human being does have a conscience and that they, and appealing to that, even if it doesn't seem like they have one.
Yeah, I keep coming back to the Rachel Corrie example, which you're familiar with that story.
Yeah.
She was standing in front of a bulldozer in 26 years ago, I think. Yes, she was an American activist who was she was nonviolently fighting against
the demolition of a home.
Demolition of homes of Palestinians, and she was bulldozed, or, you know, she was killed and the home was demolished anyways.
Yeah. And I can't remember what she was saying from the bullhorn, but, you know, she was constantly appealing to them and to their humanity. And as tragic and unbelievably brutal as that was, we still speak about her example. We still, you know, the Rachel Corrie Foundation does so much to open people's eyes to the acts of aggression that continue. So at least it's not in vain. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
That's such a good point, and you're absolutely right. So that's a really good example of honoring what happened as a nonviolent act and met with violence. But then, and we're speaking of it, and we're talking about it, and saying that, well, did that nonviolent act work? Well, maybe it did, because it opened up so many hearts. The story moves on. So there's two ways of looking at it, and I think it's not in our best interest to just become tunnel visioned in one way or another and just look at different aspects of the movement.
Right, not become black and white about it ourselves, but see the nuance, see the gray. And I really appreciate these kinds of conversations, Ari, because I feel like as a peace-building movement, so many things have gotten us, oh, you know, we focus on the differences between us instead of really building that common ground. And there are so many organizations and so many different ways. And yet, how do we be like those starlings in a murmuration and really coordinate and complement each other's differences and build on each other's strengths and find that common ground so that we can move the needle forward, which no one of us is going to do separately. So, you know, I like having these conversations to figure out that it's a nuance, not black and white, and we can agree.
It requires a lot of capacity to have those conversations, because when we are in survival mode, then we go into that binary mode, which is so dangerous for making these kinds of decisions about people, situations, or even our own bodies and minds. So we have to have capacity to be able to look at these complexities, where we go back into that savoring intervention and just keep coming back to our bodies and feeding the joy and the gratitude and the love, so we can see each other's humanity and different points of view and integrate them, rather than just make another fight of the tyranny of small differences situation happen.
And before we close, Ari, is there a place that people can go to learn some of those practices of embodied joy or resistance? Or should they go visit you at your website? Or where's the best place to find that?
Yeah, roomywithaview.com is my website. And I did this TED Talk, and I've written a number of articles about building joy and art and community, etc., that are so essential to our humanity and to building any kind of movement.
Perfect. So I would love to ask you if you had a poem or a story or a phrase or a practice that you would love to close with today.
Yeah, I think the thing that just keeps coming to me is, again, having these nuanced conversations, is one poem, one verse by Nizami Ganjavi, who was a 12th century mystic and poet. And I say it in Farsi first. آینه چون نقش تو بنمود راست، خود شکن آینه شکستن خطاست. If the mirror shows you your true face, if the mirror shows you your true face and you don't like it, you don't like what you see, break yourself, not the mirror.
Oh my gosh, Ari, you have to unpack that. That is wow. It could be like an indictment and an invitation at the same time.
It absolutely is. So much of what we don't like in another person or in a situation that we see is a part of ourselves that we're responding to, you know? Or it's either a projection. We don't like them in the other person, but we're completely blind to what we're doing. And the government, the US government, is so guilty of that right now. And most governments are, of not seeing, you know, seeing the oppression and everything else in it, all the other, or they run in government, they see the oppression in the US, but they don't see what they've done to their own protesters.
So they want to break the mirror and not actually fix themselves.
Yeah, definitely is like a, hey, pay attention. Pay attention. Why are you responding to something in this way? And that's something that I actually practice daily. Like if I have a revulsion or like a visceral reaction to something, I'm like, well, what is it in me that is responding to that? And why am I this way? And why do I need to change in myself, if anything, before I go lash out at my loved ones or at the world?
Exactly. Such an invitation to look at ourselves. Okay, I lied. Now I do want to ask you another final question. And that is, given this current environment that we're in and state, does peace resonate with you right now? Or even peace is power? Have you, or is there a different word that's coming to you too, that is needed more in this moment, or that we're needed to embody more?
Peace is not complete for me. Peace without justice is definitely not a complete. So there, it needs another component. If there is peace, at what cost do we have peace? I mean, we could have a nuclear bomb and it'll be very peaceful, you know, for a while. But what does peace need to be whole? And that's a really good exercise for me, like in any kind of a conflict resolution or in any kind of situation where I'm grappling internally. What do I need to be whole to be at peace?
That's so powerful. Thank you so much for not just this time, but who you are and what you continue to hold and your sense of agency, what you're holding, and then also what you're bringing out into the world.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. And I'm a huge fan of yours and everything that you're doing and everything that you've created. So it's been a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to our conversation. And here's your peace practice for today. Place one hand on your heart. Take a slow breath in and one slow breath out. Then ask yourself the question Ari offered us. How is my heart? Don't rush in to judge or lament, just listen. You might notice your heart is tired, or maybe it's grieving, or maybe it's angry, maybe it's grateful, maybe it's all of those things at once. And then we can ask, what do I need to feel whole? In helping to answer that question, let's find one small piece of beauty today. Maybe a song, a poem, a flower, a patch of sky, or a child's hug. Let it strengthen you. This can be our practice today, to make room for what hurts and to let beauty help us keep our hearts open. Join me next time on Peace is Power. If this show speaks to you, please follow it. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Every follow, review, and share helps more people discover the show and helps spread the power of peace a little further.